Welcome to this episode of Another World is Potable. My name is Peter Bloom, and get ready to emancipate your mind and radically expand your imagination as we present all the most exciting and revolutionary possibilities of our times, both locally and globally. I hope you enjoy it, and as always, solidarity today, tomorrow, and forever. Welcome to a new episode of Another World is Potable. We've got a fantastic guest today, someone who I think is doing such really fantastic kind of radical cutting edge work and the types of things that, I think really are what we should be doing in terms of trying to make another world possible and doing it in a way that I think is creative, empowering, and also very, very deeply, you know, about, you know, collaboratively creating the future in the present. So I want to really welcome Anka Strauss to the podcast. Thank you so much for coming.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm very looking forward to our conversation.
So I think I just want to start with a general question, which I asked all my guests, but I think for you, it's particularly kind of interesting that You are a very accomplished researcher, particularly in the area of kind of organization and work and the future of work, as well as working on questions of aesthetic and creative labor. And you also, you know, do work on art projects. So, I mean, this is it seems as almost like you have the background of like four or five people in one in a very impressive way, and you're bringing them all together. So I wonder if I could just maybe ask you very broadly, like, what is your kind of intellectual background and what was the inspiration for what you're doing?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, wow. Okay. I always have a little bit of problems of describing myself because, as you said, there are so many different positions or intellectual backgrounds with which I'm working. So I usually consider myself, my uncomfortable position is in between. That's where I usually operate. And that's also my intellectual background kind of mirrors this. I originally studied economics and business administration at a university where I could also, or was obliged to also, take classes in aesthetics and art. And I studied this because, as the main subject, because back then it was in the early 2000s, the dot-com bubble just burst, but there was this huge, at least in Germany, this hype about the economy, and that the economy was a kind of, took the position of society somehow. And so for me, it was very interesting to study this as a cultural phenomenon, as a kind of epistemology reflecting the zeitgeist of a society. That is still going on. but at the same time, what I did not like about it, so I really liked models, economic models and modeling as attempt to kind of tackle, describe what is going on in the world. But at the same time, what I did not like is use these as, or confuse it with, a narrative of truth, that this is society. So I, next to studying economics and business administration, I engaged in aesthetics and art practices as a way to question dominant ways of being and doing together. And I always found that they kind of belong together. Nobody else did at the time, but I don't know. I had this intuition that it should go together. And And after my studies, I basically went to Essex University to do my PhD in critical management studies, and trying to really go for it, to try to think these two things together. And there I very much I fell in love with post-structuralist thinkers such as Deleuze or Michel Serre, and now I've shifted again. I don't kick them, like, my inspiration comes from so many different sources that I keep them, but then I try to watch what happens always in a different key. And at the moment I'm reading a lot of, well, I feel fellow with Anna Lovinoff-Singh or J.K. Gibson-Graham and Donna Haraway and most more feminist scholars. Yeah, this is basically where I'm coming from the middle of things, I think.
Well, I always think coming from the middle of things or, you know, coming from these kind of liminal spaces that are both incredibly creative and inspiring, but also uncategorizable is usually the best place to be. And I would say on that pretty fantastic journey, we both did our PhDs at the University of Essex, and I'm actually at Essex now, so I always like to give a shout out to Essex.
Yeah, that's right.
So, in that respect, I mean, you've been working on a range of different work, and I think that interestingly, there has been, like you said, part of this regard is this creative economy, but in many ways, what we've actually seen is that creativity, in many ways, is one of the most exploited aspects of contemporary capital. But you seem to still take on a, if I can be so bold, as a kind of more revolutionary point about, let's think about this from a point of like, what would an actual form of radical creative practice be as it relates to work? And you've been working on this project around working utopias. So I would really be interested in that because I think that, you know, this is a time that requires reimagination. But at the same time, I think that this kind of liberal ethos of, well, let's just imagine things differently, or let's talk about the future of work in a very abstract way, is the exact opposite of where we should be. So you've seemingly really innovatively brought these together, but kind of almost materialist, you know, project of utopianism. So what is working utopias? What, where did it come from? And what is, what do you see as, you know, its importance for contemporary radical thought and praxis?
Well, okay, well, I just would like to make a little side mark on the notion of radical or radicalism. It's funny because I never considered myself radical. I just thought this is much more sensible. So I very much resonate with radical writers or also these practices, but I kind of refrain from explicitly calling this radical, because I think it should much more be the norm, and not calling it radical is, for me personally, a kind of prefiguration, that assuming that this is the norm and practicing it accordingly, for me it is much more, I don't know, it gives me more potential for me in thinking and in also being radical. Then putting it into this little, in this box. And I know that I think it's important that others do it and that they, make it visible as such. But I personally don't do it while I know that it is what, yeah,
No,
what I.
I think that makes a lot of sense, and you know, the revolution only really has won when it's become seen as the norm and the sensible, and I think that's a good prefiguration. So yeah, no, absolutely.
Thanks. I just wanted to, I didn't want to say, I totally reject the notion of radical practice. Yeah, I just wanted to say, okay, I use it not so often because for me it blocks more for myself than enables me to do things. Working utopia. So Working Utopias is a project that I started together with the performance artist Christina Chupke. And we were in 2015, and it was funded by a big foundation and that wanted to set up a new funding scheme for art scientists collaborations, and basically we were the guinea pigs, and they immediately scratched it afterwards. But to us, it enabled us to have a lot of space to try out things. And so Christina and me were interested in the notion of utopia or utopianism, because in 2015 already utopia didn't have a lot of space in discourse. There was a lot of dystopian narratives and also art practices and products that they engage more with dystopianism than anything else. So we were interested in utopia, and when we also realized that one field where dystopianism is quite heavy or intense is work, because work has been discussed a lot with for instance, the notion of precarization, of ubiquitous competition, then of work that is not there anymore, so unemployment, but also so there's too little work or there's too much work. When we talk about burnout and all these kind of things. So we said, okay, we would like to connect that and turn it into a project that is on the fringes, between the art and research and performance art and organization studies. And it kind of has two functions, or it has two ways of, looking, two directions of looking at this phenomenon. On the one hand, it's very practical. It's about the utopia of work. So basically what we did, we said, okay, who is this subject that today you can call it neoliberalist ways of organizing our work lives is the ideal and the, in a positive way and the negative way. It's basically the artists, it's the ideal of the creative individual. You said it in your introduction. And also this highly exploited subjectivity at the same time. So that it's both at the same time. And then we thought, okay, so if artists organize their own work lives, how would that look like? We were pretty sure that it wouldn't look like management-inspired ways of organizing. And we said, okay, let's do like a classical research part. Let's explore collaboration under conditions of highly individualized work regimes. Let's go and interview or spend time with artists who organize their own work lives together with others, or to kind of organize this togetherness under these conditions of individualism. And to seek alternative ways of organizing our being with one another on this planet. And to me, this is much broader than just cultural production. I think the questions that are addressed in these practices, they can be, they can transgress the cultural sphere. And that's what I'm actually currently trying to work on, is how can we rethink organizations on a much broader scale? So this is the one like hands-on part. And the other one is what is the workings of utopias. How do utopian narratives animate practices? And so this is the part that is much more engaged with questions of affectivities that drive us. And we think that at the moment, our organization, or in general, organizational practices are much more driven by fear than anything else. And the question is there a different affect that can drive our actions? And so this is the other side that is much more ephemeral and difficult to tackle than the hands-on practices. Yeah, and in order to do this, we also basically did art. So we tried to engage with these questions and also to share what we found out in a way that's not necessarily academic writing, because especially affectivity runs on a very different plane. I like reading about affect studies, but especially in organization studies, this is highly, highly, highly theoretical. It's not very tactile, or, you know, it's not very embodied. And therefore, we decided to have more formats like a performative installation where you can listen to things while you practice certain other things that kind of allows affects to circulate instead of, you know, theoretically writing about it. So you can know on a different level.
I think, so in a certain sense.
Say it again.
Sorry. So it seems like on a certain sense that there's kind of two really interesting points here. I mean, one is the actual findings that you had, which I'd like to explore more. And then also about how do you allow for these types of different ways of doing this kind of more utopian senses to be not just something on a page or not just something that one reads, but actually something that's a bit more embodied. So what is, you know, something very deeply about the tactile and affective component of, you know, whether you want to call it radical or however you want to call it, of thinking through these kind of utopian changes. So I think we could just maybe start on the first point, though. You know, for you, like, what were some of the most interesting findings that you saw?
There are quite a lot of different findings that I find, you know, that I find so interesting that I'm still thinking about them. How to, you know, they still work through my body somehow. And they are connected. And I would, you know, kind of subsume them on under the notion of, or the core, I would call it, it's a very different mode of organizing. So what is interesting is while our, you know, the dominant ways of organizing, they run on homogeneity. That is what makes them efficient. And in these kind of organizations, they thrive on difference. And so a lot of practices are focused on enabling difference. I think Hannah Arendt once wrote about it. There is an equality in difference, and that's what they really thrive upon. You know, if every you know artist or every creative producer or cultural producer would be the same, it just would not work. And then there are, you know, there are these constantly these negotiations around how to how to enable difference and have rules that, you know, hold for everybody despite the difference or with the difference. and how to enable this difference. And this is the second thing that is quite related. How can you reimagine this organization again and again and again, so that you're not stuck in one kind of form? And a third thing that is related, it is somehow as if the center of the organization of this form is empty. It has to be empty so it can be, you know, reinvented again and again. And this reinvention again and again is what makes it very, very lively. So it's a very, often they're very vibrant spaces. The downside of it is that sometimes the people involved there's so much demand on it that obviously they sometimes are at the close to burnout or something like that. And then, you know, often in this organization, there's a shift to, okay, how can we have responsibilities distributed on many shoulders, not just on very few? Or can we have a revolving system of this? So there is this this constant movement into certain structures, out of certain structures, or into different structures. And I think this movements or these floating structure is much more what can be described, and it's when looking at these or engaging with these organizations. It's very broad.
Very broad, but I think that's fantastic. I mean, I remember, you know, writing a piece about, you know, this kind of thing is about how a rent theory can give us an idea of organizations and organizing as a form of kind of radical domesticity, right? Like, mm-hmm. as you can feel at home, but a point in which you continually reorganize and rearrange. But one of the aspects that I always felt uncomfortable with, and I think you touched on really brilliantly there, was that when you're engaged in this process of, you know, even kind of very transformative, and you mm-hmm. go through the there's a lot of labor that goes into that.
Yeah.
Right. And really thinking about not just processes of utopianism, whether they be kind of more practical or whether they be kind of more kind of traditional forms of reimagination, but what is the labor in doing otherwise? What is the creative labor in that? And I think that's really something that, I think it's worth thinking about, especially when you think about oftentimes who, in terms of intersectional power relations, mm-hmm. is often asked to do this, right? I mean, one of the things, though, that I was interested in terms of that, though, if I can, because I'd like to return to that, is this idea, though, also of the tactile part of this kind of working utopias. And the reason I ask that, you know, I think just, you know, last week, Mark Zuckerberg announced that we were going to soon head into the metaverse, right? Mm-hmm. And I think you can ridicule that, but people are looking at virtual kind of worlds and also looking at digital platforms as points in which to foster new types of kind of, you know, human connections.
Yeah.
But also as places to reimagine and, you know, rework quite literally what our economy could be.
Yeah.
And for myself, you know, I find that quite exciting, though I find that in a kind of Foucauldian way very dangerous as well. I mean, I definitely see the dangers in that.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, from your view, like, how do you think, because I think that affective part that you talk about, that very embodied part, that tactile part, is so mm-hmm. important. How do you see this kind of more hybrid spaces emerging, and do you see them as compatible with these kinds of very, you know, in-person, tactile, embodied form of reimagination?
Good question. Okay, I think first of all, interestingly, I had a conversation yesterday with a performance artist who basically, and it was about work and how to share ideas, how to share practices, how to share money. And she basically said, you know, she gets really, really angry with being marginalized as an artist, as being just the one who's just doing the gloss in society, or, you know, the glitter, or, you know, not really important things. Because she said, you know, aesthetic practices and this aesthetization of, you know, your environment, is that's what artists used to do. And this has been completely taken over by, for instance, the digital, digital corporations. So it has, you know, already been translated very, very effectively and, successfully into also recreating our economy in a certain way, where the digital or the virtual sphere plays such an important role, and basically restructures our society as it is today. And she said the problem with this is not acknowledged because the aesthetic practices or the form has been taken over without the attitude. And the attitude for her is related to a certain kind of coming together of humans in order to, you know, negotiate, you know, who they are and how they are in the world. And this is basically not happening in the universe of Mark Zuckerberg. And I think this attitude is can be described of how can I say that? In the areas that I'm researching or that I'm engaging with, the question is always a question of how to be with one another. Others are there is this notion of equality in there, and things grow through connections and not through a colonialist gesture. And I think in the digital sphere, aesthetics is often used or usually used to restructure our society in a way that has colonialism in its core. It's a notion that is linked to a project of conquering somehow, and I think with this kind of, you know, like using aesthetics in that way is to restructure society into chains of, and I would call it parasitical chains, you know, like where a lot of people or a lot of beings or existences are rearranged in a way that the last one in the chain is Mark Zuckerberg, and, you know, and resources flow towards this direction. They always flow towards the direction of the, you know, the last parasite in this chain. And I think this is the big difference, that on the one hand, aesthetic practices are engaged with regard to this attitude of equality and difference, to negotiate a being with one another. And on the other hand, it's engaged towards, rearranging society to further the concentration of wealth, let it flow towards the end of the if you want to call it value change or whatever you want to call it. But I don't know, does that, does it
no.
at all answer your question?
I actually think very, very much. And the reason why I think that's really good as well is it kind of shows how these actual kind of user connections represent deeper economic connections, right? And to a certain extent, I think the parasitic aspect is really apparent. I mean, one of the points that is there's that we have a lot of new civic technologies, for instance, that allow for great things like participatory budgeting, right?
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that is often forgotten is that these are based on, you know, oftentimes, you know, rare earth mining that is incredibly exploitative, right? Mm-hmm. And making visible these things and who's connected and who's disconnected is really important. And I do think that in a way, you know, I like that point as well about thinking through it in terms of not necessarily just the medium, but the connection.
Mm.
And that's a really wonderful way to think about it. And it does make me think though, you know, going back to something that we kind of touched on, or I thought you touched on very well, which is that, you know, in a way, to a certain extent, I think we often forget that these forms of connection do require labor.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah.
And I think the point that I really like that you started with the artist friend of yours and colleague about, you know, we're not just kind of the cosmetics or superficial, like, you know, we are engaged in something very substantive and serious. I think one of the points that you could find from that as well is this reality that, you know, if we do look at the creative impulse as, or in the creative practice as something that can allow us to actually engage in, you know, utopian practices, it's worth thinking about, as I think you originally said, like, how, what is the labor involved in that? What's the labor involved about being an artist of one's own life?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we think about that in terms of, you know, in many ways, making sure it's not exploitative, but also dissipating some of its opportunity costs? I mean, I think, you know, we use a lot of buzzwords like connections, but I think all of us know that, you know, maintaining connections with others, even really empowering ones, can be a lot of work.
Yeah.
Like a lot of work.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And and this is exactly also what is negotiated a lot at the moment, as at least in the performance artist scene that I'm part of. The interesting thing is because you know you cannot disconnect work from life there. It's impossible. You know, it's artificial. It doesn't really make sense. What is very interesting is that they do it through practices that are joyful. So it is a lot of work to foster connections and to maintain connections. And what I've been doing in the last year and a half together with Antje Pfundner, who's a performance artist in Hamburg, who has initiated, you know, regular meetings on talking about work conditions and to do it in such a joyful way that, you know, that there is a notion of friendship that has developed through that work. And so meeting for working on relationships and on the question of relationships, they also have this this connotation of, you know, they give back more than just money. They, you know, they energize, they enable you to get out of your everyday working routine in order to reflect on it on a different level. And that's very, very important. And what she's actually doing at the moment, she's also basically pushing the funding bodies to include that into funding, because, you know, that has not been there for a long time, although it's very important. And artists do it all the time, But they meet on parties to talk about their work, and they don't have a private life anymore. And so she pushes it into these financial bodies who basically finance artists' work to acknowledge the fact that this is a lot of labor, you know, and that artistic products or productions, they also derive from this informal exchange or on a more structural level. That's just a side note. I just quickly would like to come back to the question that you asked before. You asked about the tactile dimension of, you know, radical imaginaries or thinking about alternative ways of organizing our being together. And especially with regard to the Facebook, for instance, I think what tech companies do, and I think they do it actively, and I think they believe it themselves, I would call it technologies of disconnections. They basically foster the idea that we are disconnected from our environment. And because the virtual does not really need a body, you know, like your body only has to function as long as, you know, it can, you know, enter the virtual sphere. So it does not, you know, it does not need particular capabilities that only a body is capable of, like jumping or, you know, standing or something like that, as long as you can sit in front of the computer and follow, you know, the world that is elsewhere, that's fine. You know, you should only make sure that you don't starve to death or something like that. But this technologies of disconnections and this belief of that you are independent of your body, I think mirrors in very, very different initiatives. And, you know, going to space is one, you know, because then you can start exploiting the space and get all the materials that you might not find on Earth anymore because you've exploited the mines in anywhere. To maintain the resources for these technological advances, but also this kind of idea of, you know, uploading your mind, artificial intelligence, all these kind of things are mirroring an advanced belief in, and also this belief is supported by technologies of disconnection that, to me, also affect heavily society. I mean, Zygmunt Bauman wrote about it, you know, in Liquid Modernity, but there are various people writing about it that, you know, we currently face a disconnection that does not only affect our society because we're disconnected from other people, but we're also disconnected from our environment. And that's why we're also incapable of acting sustainably. So remembering that you have a body in the world, I think is, you cannot do without it.
And I think that's also very interesting, the fact that, you know, this kind of re-embodying of oneself as they engage in all forms of digital labor is so crucial. I think about this in terms of the ways in which, you know, the use of Zoom, the use of kind of like, working from home, which is, you know, increasingly prevalent, especially with the pandemic.
Yeah.
So much of wellness is remembering that actually you do have a body.
Yeah.
It does need to be cared for. And I find it interesting that, as you kind of pointed out, that if you look at like a lot of the virtual world, so much of it is almost forgetting that you have a body by ironically creating a new virtual body. And mm-hmm. This becomes in and of itself a form of not just escapism, but of a way of really denying, I think that you spoke about earlier, the deeper economic connections that are embodied in our practices and actions. And I think that kind of brings me to another point, which is, you know, I'm very interested in this relationship between kind of how we think about art and organization on the one hand, especially as the ways in which you've been speaking about it, and then looking at about new forms of knowing, but also how we distinguish between our work and our lives, right? And I think one of the dangers that, and I think a danger in a good and bad way, I guess, is that when we start to think about, you know, the point of kind of utopian working, I could see this being something that somewhat mirrors kind of the boundaryless working of contemporary capitalism or neoliberalism, in which, you know, you're never really off. So how do we create this more joyful set of practices with also recognizing that, you know, we've fought hard to create a separation between work and life?
Yeah. I totally agree with you. I actually do not function in I'm not really good at separating work and life, to be frank. And I also, if I try to do it, then I start being blocked, because then I feel so much at work when I work, and yeah, and it's, and I kind of, yeah, I have difficulties to basically draw the boundaries, because, you know, when I, probably, you know, that you also, when you research, you know, you don't stop after 8 hours, you know, and then just go home and stop thinking. So this is very difficult. But I actually like to think work, like to rethink work and the notion of work, because and it has been done since the 60s, of course, with feminist, you know, approaches to work. Work is not just paid labor, right? It's not just the job that you're doing, but work is much more related to labor. Everything that sustains you is also labor, without, you know, making it too big or hard on, you know, oh God, everything is labor. But I think the devaluation of recreational labor is a huge problem when it comes to thinking about, you know, how can we rethink the relationship between work and non-work. I think this binary is already, this bifurcation is already the problem. And what I much more like is this notion of total social organization of labor. It comes from, oh God, that's really a bit embarrassing. It's a sociologist who used to be at Essex, but I forgot her name at the moment. And but what I find interesting there is to think about what, you know, what does it need for you to be well in your life? You know, what are the different kinds of activities that sustain you and, you know, what your capacity to do what you do, and to widen the view on work. And I think that's also why I said, why I find it interesting or important of the artists I collaborate with to turn even, you know, official work situations into joyful events, so that you get more out of it than just get the job done. Because there you have a kind of fusion of both things, and that also allows acknowledging when you need a rest, or when you need to go for a walk, or when you need to read a book, or you go to a museum, you know, or when you need to feed your, or spend time with your kids or your family, because that actually belongs to the sphere of, and usually call it work life, to, you know, make clear that it's maybe not so productive to maintain this distinction, but you know, in calling, but acknowledging that work also needs all the other activities.
And I think, you know, I think it was Marion Glucksman who was at Essex. She's still an emeritus professor, but I think that's a really, really, and I always think it's interesting that, because, you know, the first guest who also says, oh, because it's not embarrassing at all. Like, it's I think I always forget things like all the time. I barely remember what I had for dinner yesterday. So,
okay, good.
but no, I mean, I think in that respect, you know, that way about thinking about how when we recognize that, you know, labor needs to be socially organized, that also gives us the ability to take seriously where we put these limits of work, how we think about labor in that respect. And, you know, for me, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think that is an artistic practice as well, because I think many of us, and I do include myself in this, you know, have trouble making those boundaries. And part of that is because of the ways in which capitalism works. But also, I think part of it is just how much we invest in things that we're passionate about.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, that notion of being able to understand, you know, everything we do as a form of labor, and then being able to really investigate, you know, in a kind of critical way of, this is really wonderful, but what is the labor I attach to? You know, how could I think about this differently? I mean, one of the aspects that I was very interested in on the tactile sense is this kind of temporality of work, mm-hmm. and also, you know, and I think about this quite a bit, because in many ways, you know, the ability to slow down, the ability to redefine what makes something successful, and in what time frame.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really interesting, especially because it's one thing to say it, but I've always thought, and I'm not and I say this even though I think we're all tactile fundamentally, you know, I'm not the most quote-unquote tactile type of learner, but certainly in terms of time, that's something that I've always felt that I can't just make up in my head.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have to feel it. And I think there are certain things that have made the pandemic harder to do it. Like, I mean, I think, God, this is going to sound very bourgeois, so I apologize, but sometimes I specifically put myself in spaces like the gym during times, because that is such a total spatial, physical disconnect from work.
Yeah.
And I find it, I can't speak about this, but quite difficult sometimes to engage in this kind of new types of temporalities without that ability to engage spatially.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah.
You know, so I didn't know how you felt about that, because I think that point about time, and I think the ability to you know, bring some of these creative practices and these kind of artistic practices into how we experience time, I personally feel is like quite important for any serious kind of project of social transformation.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I absolutely agree with you on both arguments. I think space is, you know, or time is very much linked to space. So it's, and I think this is, again, you know, the fact that we do not acknowledge that we have a body also means that we do not really see the importance of, you know, spatial arrangements, and the, you know, the basically the use of different spaces, and all, you know, I think Timon Bais and Chris Dyett, they called it spacing, you know, how we do this and how we need this, and I also agree with you that that the temporal aspect, because it's so linked, you know, it's, and the pandemic has actually shown us how difficult it is to maintain certain rhythms or different rhythms, or not to let work, and I mean paid labor at the moment, you know, encroach on our lives, you know. because we were all locked up in the same space that we used everywhere and for everything, I realized that, for instance, my rhythm of work has changed in a way that work has intensified so much that there was very little left outside of work, and that was unhealthy. And I think a lot of people have experienced that. And I think it's very important to think about what are the rhythms of working and, you know, or different kinds of labor that help you to, well, not help you, that actually not only sustain you, that but makes you who you are, you know, and sustains you in this. And I think in that respect, a rhythm analysis is very, very promising when it comes to thinking about what, you know, how else can we organize our work lives and with whom and in which spaces. Yeah, I agree with you, absolutely. And the interesting thing is about the artistic projects or organization or artist-run organizations we have looked at, they often talk about rhythms, you know, of rhythm of contracting and letting go, of rhythm of intensive work and, you know, idleness. And so they are basically thinking their work lives, maybe also because they are project-based, in rhythms, and also have identified that the funding structures, the way funding works at the moment, destroys these kinds of rhythms, and that it also intensifies their labor on various bases. But the most important is that they are always project-based financing schemes. So whenever these artists have completed a project, there is the intense time of, you know, writing new funding applications. And there's no, and this rhythm has intensified so much that most of them said, Corona has given me the much, much needed break, because I was actually running, into a kind of burnout, and I'm not sure whether I could have recovered from that. Yeah, and I think that when we think about sustainable ways of being with one another, time is the crucial factor. And when you look at how companies start to, or like all these platform economies start to invent new business models based on time, and I'm thinking about all these platforms who promise that they deliver food within 10 minutes. This is, you know, this is the new field of exploitation, I think. And
it does, I mean, kind of bring back to one question, and then I want to ask a final question about kind of how this can relate to the actual social struggles. But in the sense that when we think about project work and when we think about organizations, one thing in which they oftentimes have a difference with at least the consumption of art is that there is a way in which one can engage with art in that kind of famous phrase, you know, art for art's sake. And while that is never purely true, there is a way in which one of the beauties of art is that you can simply enjoy it without a purpose or without an explicit purpose or without something that is very much about, you know, my professional or personal development. And I'm wondering how that can translate into organizational life, especially the kind of really serious transformative organizational life you're speaking, because I do feel that, you know, especially as things are run on a more project basis, and especially as we think about like what supposedly is the fundamental ontology of organization and organizing, which is that there always has to be, you know, this kind of deep purpose to it, a very explicit purpose. Mm-hmm. And we do know, and it goes back to the liminality that we spoke about at the beginning of the exam between spaces, that so much of the greatest points of creativity, so much of the greatest experiences of joy we have, are those things that we do for their own sake, as a kind of complete openness. So I'm wondering, how can we think about, you know, organization and organizing and the kind of utopian practices of organization, the kind of the performativity of utopians in a way that allows us to begin thinking about organizing and organizations in a way that isn't so prescriptive or intention based?
I think this is related to where I basically feel is the overlap between organization and art practice. Both are involved with organizing practice and art practice. Both are involved with questions of how. So they can be considered as static practices. In a similar way as artworks do have a theme, you know, like they don't necessarily have to be, have a title, but artists do have, you know, an intention of going somewhere, and which is usually researching a certain theme or like engaging with a certain theme in order to produce a certain knowing about it. Or open up a different way of looking at it. And so it's not that they're not without purpose, but it's not about giving a solution to something. Whereas in organizations, much, especially when it is organized under a regime of management, it's always about solutions and to problems, you know, that are very specific. But what they share is, so I think they do, organizations and art does both have a certain kind of purpose or theme or something like that. But I think at the same time, in contrast to, yeah, management dominated organization structures or approaches, art is not about a prescriptive way of doing things, you know, this is, or a predetermined way of doing things. And this is what you also said, you know, when we talk about organization, it's often very prescriptive and also kind of in a way abstract that can be, you know, that claims to be able to be translated into various different contexts. But what I find interesting when it comes to or trying to write about organizations or different practices without prescribing a certain, you know, function or a way of going forward in an abstract way is to trying to this is super difficult. Trying to describe organization practices on a more aesthetic level, and there we things come in like space. You know, how do you space organizations, or how do you introduce and negotiate different rhythms? And I think looking at organizations or trying to formulate approaches that are connected to such more aesthetic realms of, you know, talking about the world, allows you to be specific without determining what is, you know, what you actually have to do. It's a bit like dipping into overdetermination, you know, because you cannot be everything at once. And so there is a kind of there's space to move within this kind this within a certain approach to organization, and it's, I know it sounds terribly abstract what I'm talking about, but I might give you an example of an art organization that or artist run organization that is in France, that's called PAF. I've already talked about my little talk in at ISS, but But this is what I'm actually currently thinking about. So this is very present at the moment. So they have basically three rules. They added a fourth one. And these three rules are organizational rules. And at the same time, they create a kind of paradox that makes it necessary to negotiate what is your personal interpretation or the interpretation with the other people at that moment of this these organizational rules. So the first one is make it possible for others. So not just for yourself, but also for others. The second one is don't leave traces. And it doesn't really matter whether it's traces in, you know, don't clutter rooms or spaces here. You know, you can use that, but then you, you know, get all your stuff out. But also don't leave traces like in a negative way on other people, you know, by shouting at them or something like that. And the third one is the doer decides. You know, it's not the people who talk, it's the people who do who decide what happens. But that obviously creates paradox because when you are, you know, doing something, you might not make it possible for others to do something. Or you create, you know, you clutter the space at that point and you might leave traces. So, and, you know, this creates this paradoxical situation where there are rules, but you have to negotiate rules at that very moment. And I think that makes a lot of things possible. And very similar rules are also, you know, you can meet them in other artist-run organizations where, you know, you have a rules and then you have a rule that kind of undermines the rule that you have more space to, you know, negotiate things. And when you think about universities, for instance, the organizations we both know very well, and that is very, very structured and very stiff rules, let's put it this way, you know, that excludes a lot and where people do sometimes work in their free time that, you know, would normally be part of your workplace practices. If you start having rules that, you know, allow you to breathe more, let's put it this way, I think it would take a lot of burden from people working there. And I think it would also open up again, you know, possibilities to renegotiate your work and also to, to renegotiate also, for instance, the relationship to your students or to your research or to your colleagues or to your management. I think something is in there that how can I say that? That is productive in rethinking alternative ways of organizing that allow us a more sustainable way of, you know, organizing our work and life. That is much needed, actually.
that is so like really inspiring because I think that in a certain sense, firstly, looking at organizations as spaces of experimentation and as something in which, you know, you're not trying to do everything at once. You're trying to explore different things and see where they take you. But then also the ways in which you create rules so that they can be deconstructed, right?
Yeah.
And in a way, something you said at the very beginning of the interview, which is, you know, so much of our working life is based on fear. And even when they try to say wellness or empowerment, it's fear of losing a job. It's fear of, you know, not having material security. I think it shows that, you know, if you can create systems and structures that gets rid or eliminates or reduces significantly that fear, not only do you give, you know, in a kind of class sense, more labor power to workers, individuals, you also provide them the actual space to fundamentally transform their relationship with organizing an organization so that it's not one based on having to meet these certain goals, but it is one that's based on shared possibility and shared experimentation. And I think, I don't know personally, like when I hear you speak like that, like it's like, you know, it makes me really excited about the potential of the different type of society and world. What could our lives and organizations be? And it's something I don't think we think about enough, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a bit as if we have naturalized the way we organize or and are organized by, you know, but in the end, it's, you know, we made it. It was us. It's not somebody else. It's not a god. It's not a gene or whatever, you know. It's in the end, it's us. And I think we tend to forget about it. And I think it's also intentional that we do forget about the fact that actually we produce our own world. We are constantly engaged in practices of worlding, and that's, you know, yeah.
So, you know, I think, you know, this is like, we definitely have to have you back on. You know, you're doing so much interesting things, but I think this is a really inspiring place to stop that, you know, we don't just have the ability to live in a different world, we can actually create it and we can be involved in this worlding. And one of the things that, you know, when I'm looking at the things that you're doing, and I've heard all the amazing things that you've said about, you know, in many ways we have the revolution so that we can get on with the work of worlding in a way that is joyful, empowering, and also something that is constantly in flux. And I really was going to say, you know, another world's not only possible, but possible. And you were such a huge part of it. So thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much.
I be your mirror. I be your mirror.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Another World is Potable. My name is Peter Bloom, and remember, until next time, another world is not only possible, but happening right now.